As we continue our time in the book of Acts this morning, I don't know what it was like maybe for you growing up. I imagine for most of us, you probably had this similar experience. I remember going to school, and basically when you're growing up, you're kind of told like, hey, do this grade, pass, go to the next grade. And it's like, as long as you do the thing, you knew your next path. Like life was pretty linear. You go from third, fourth, fifth grade, you just keep going up, keep doing the thing, keep going up. And then, you know, like at least ideally, it's like, hey, try to go to college. And so even after you graduate high school, you know your next step. And I remember kind of like doing the thing. When at first, like freshman year of college, first kind of hit me of like, okay, I know I have like my next 4 years kind of planned out, but there's no longer this guarantee that if I do this, then the next thing's going to come for me. Because then you graduate college and then you realize, oh, like just because you graduated college or maybe you got straight A's, it didn't guarantee you're going to get the job that you wanted. And so basically you kind of grow up assuming one thing and then you become an adult and you realize, oh, like everything is not so linear. It's not just if I do this, then this is the next step. In fact, it could be kind of combobulated. Things can go a lot of different directions. And I just remember thinking, man, all these kids that got straight A's, like it doesn't actually guarantee them anything. So I'm not telling your kids, like, don't do good in school, but like, didn't actually guarantee everybody necessarily anything. And I share that because today as we continue our time in the book of Acts, here's what I know. Here's kind of like the question we're looking at as we continue today to this. We think that faithfulness should feel like progress, but what if it doesn't? I think oftentimes we think, hey, if I follow Jesus and I love Jesus and I do the right thing and I go to church and I read the Bible and I study and have community, then like my faith progression is going to look up and to the right. And maybe there'll be like a few small hiccups, but if anything, they'll be small. But then you do this Jesus thing for a while, and if you've been following Jesus really for really any length of time, man, you've probably come across like I thought that I would be further along. Like, I thought I still wouldn't have this issue. And so we often think that if I'm being faithful, it should feel like progress. And if I don't feel like I'm progressing, maybe does that mean I'm actually not being faithful? And so that's what we're going to look at this morning. And so if you have a Bible, you can turn with me to Acts chapter 23. If you don't have a Bible, there's some black ones in the back of the auditorium. You can grab one of those if you would like to read along. And if you do not own a Bible, we just say, hey, I'd love for you to take one of those black ones home. It is our gift to you. But if you have a Bible or a phone and want to read along with us, we're going to be in Acts chapter 23. Last week, basically, we're kind of getting closer to the end of Acts, and Acts is the story of the early church. For the last several chapters, we've been following along this guy by the name of the Apostle Paul, and last week we saw that he has returned to Jerusalem after his third missionary journey that's documented in the book of Acts, and there's a Roman mob in Jerusalem that almost kills him. Some of the Jews aren't really happy with him because he's been telling like Gentiles, hey, Jesus' sacrifice counts for you, and you can be a follower of Jesus without following the dietary food laws or circumcision or some of the ritual purity things that the Old Testament Jews followed because Jesus is the one that makes us clean. So there's a lot of tension there. They kind of accuse Paul of doing something he didn't actually do. A massive mob forms. They either kill him. And so Paul is in Roman custody in the temple. All 200 centurion soldiers come in, try to figure this out. And the Romans are trying to figure out, okay, what did this guy do to cause such a massive riot? What actually happened? And so they bring him before the Jewish religious council to get some answers. So Paul makes a speech. People kind of get into a riot again. And so they arrest him and they say, hey, we're going to give you back to the Jewish religious leaders so that they can give us formal charges so that we know, the Roman governing authorities, what to do with you. So they're trying to figure out what to do with Paul. So we're going to actually start the last verse of Acts 22, verse 30, and then we'll be in Acts 30 or 23 today. I'll just say this. The last couple of chapters in the book of Acts are just like long narrative stories. And so last week, this week, the next couple of weeks, I'm really just going to do like a little bit of a Bible study. So I'm pretty much just going to read and explain, and then at the end, we'll kind of bring it all together for you. So Acts 22, starting in verse 30, we'll pick up the story. It says this. The next day, since this is the Roman guard in charge, wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he, again the Roman officer, released him and instructed the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to convene. He brought Paul down and placed him before them. So again, Claudius, he's the officer in charge, and he is trying to figure out why Paul caused such an uproar. And so he sends Paul to the Sanhedrin, which is a council of 70 religious Jewish religious leaders who kind of self-governed the Jews. And then if they had any big cases, they would bring it to the Romans to persecute. Again, they're trying to figure out what's going on. So he sends him to the Sanhedrin, hey, find out some formal charges, and so we can charge Paul and see if he's guilty or not. Chapter 23, verse 1, it says this. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, brothers, I have lived my life before God in all conscience to this day. The high priest, Ananias, ordered those who were standing next to him to strike him on the mouth. So again, Paul gets brought into this council. He claims that he has been following God faithfully. And then you have the high priest, who was the spiritual leader of Israel. He was the highest religious authority in Judaism. He oversaw the temple worship in Jerusalem. He was the one who would enter the Holy of Holies, or on the Day of Atonement, the most holy part of the Jewish temple. And he served as the chief representative between God and God's people. Now, it's just helpful to know that by the time of the New Testament, by the time of the first century, the high priest also held significant influence and often cooperated with Roman authorities to try to get things to happen for the Jews. He knew the Roman governors, and so it wasn't like kind of the best ideal. A lot of them ended up being pretty corrupt. As we know historically, Ananias was also pretty corrupt as well. And so what happens is he orders Paul to be struck on the mouth, which was done something not just to like hit someone because it's like, hey, I don't like what you said. It was also something that was done if somebody said something that was offensive. It was a way of like marking, hey, like you can't do that. We don't know for sure, but it also may have been Jewish practice that if somebody dishonored God or defiled God with their speech, they would be struck on the mouth as a designation of like, hey, what you said was wrong. You need to repent. So he has Paul struck, basically disagreeing with Paul's assessment that Paul has been faithful. Verse 3, then Paul said to him, so again, speaking to the high priest, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. You are sitting there judging me according to the law. And he's talking about the Jewish law in the Old Testament. And yet, in violation of the law, you are ordering me to be struck. In other words, Paul calls Ananias, and again, if you've been with us, this is different than Ananias, who we read about in Acts chapter 9, who was a Jewish Christian. This is Ananias, the high priest. He calls Ananias, who ordered Paul to be slapped, a whitewashed wall. Now, this is the same expression that Jesus used for some of the religious leaders, for example, in Matthew chapter 23, to expose their hypocrisy. And it's just helpful to know that the tombs in ancient Israel were whitewashed on the outside so that they would look clean. But inwardly, on the inside, the tombs would hold death and decay. On the inside, they were actually impure. So to call someone a whitewashed wall means, hey, listen, you look good on the outside, but inside you are spiritually dead. So Paul is basically saying the biggest Roman Jewish authority at this time, he's like, you're spiritually dead. In other words, what Paul is saying is also what you've done, Ananias, is you've acted unlawful. So you're leading this meeting. But what he did to Paul was unlawful because Paul had not yet had a trial, which was a violation of his due process. So if someone were to order you struck on the mouth, it's pretty much saying that you're guilty without actually being found guilty. So according to both Roman law and even Jewish law, like that shouldn't have happened. Paul has not been found guilty yet, so you can't do something like this that would signify he was guilty. So he accuses Ananias of being the one who violates the law. Verse 4. Those standing nearby said, do you dare revile God's high priest? So they're understandably upset that Paul pretty much like mocked in some ways the high priest. It's like, that's like a big no-no. Verse 5, Paul says this, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, replied Paul, for it is written, you must not speak evil of a ruler of your people. In other words, what Paul is doing here is that it was against the law, so according to Exodus chapter 22, verse 8, to revile or curse the high priest. In Acts 22, it says this, you must not blaspheme God or curse a leader among your people. In other words, if he is the high priest, he is like the leaders of leaders, there should be some amount of respect for the office. Now, again, we do know as a side note, historically, from people like Josephus, Ananias was actually a pretty bad and corrupt high priest, which is pretty much the high priesthood was by the time of the first century. They actually, all that to say, like Paul's statement is probably more true than Paul even realizes, that what he said about the high priest. However, it appears that Paul didn't know that Ananias was the high priest. So he didn't know that he was actually speaking to the high priest. It probably is because this council was kind of convened rather quickly. Ananias probably is not dressed in his typical high priestly garb because they're trying to do this trial. And Ananias at this point had been the high priest for about 10 years, but Paul had rarely spent any time at all in Jerusalem in the past 10 years. So without his kind of high priestly garb, Paul would not have recognized Ananias as the high priest. So he realizes what's going on here. He realizes how he spoke to the high priest, and then he apologizes for the way that he spoke to him, given his position. Now, I think it's fair to say what he's apologizing for is kind of how he spoke to the high priest, not the truth of what he said. So the truth of what he said was not wrong. Now, again, we don't know for sure, but the way in which Paul responded to the slap here, I think, would have been very different had he known that he was talking to the high priest. Now, his message might have been different, but kind of his, like, hey, what you've done to me is wrong, I think he still would have communicated that. Now, I just want to say this. As I was, you know, reading this passage, just very personally, I was pretty struck by Paul's response here to the high priest. Because, listen, if you're Paul, I mean, you just got hit. You're being charged unlawfully. You're pretty angry. I mean, I would be pretty angry. And yet, immediately, he finds out who he is speaking to, and he is trying to honor God no matter what. He's trying to honor God even in this situation when he's really upset. And to me, it was just pretty convicting. Like, he's upset. He's mad. The high priest is in the wrong. And yet, when he finds out it's the high priest, he said, no, listen, I apologize for that. I should have been more respectful for the office. At least to me, I think it says a lot about Paul. And so, continuing on, verse 6, it says this. When Paul realized that one part of them were the Sadducees and the other part were Pharisees, he cried out in the Sanhedrin. Now, again, just kind of a little Bible study today, just so you can know the context here. The Sanhedrin was made up of 70 members. And given that this is a pretty rushed situation, Paul's like brought in, hey, figure out what's going on. Very likely that all 70 are not present at this particular time. Also, because Paul used to be a Pharisee, he knows that both the Pharisees and the Sanhedrins, which were kind of like different sects of Judaism, made up the Sanhedrin. So when it says that Paul realized that one part were Sadducees and one part were Pharisees, it's not like, oh, he didn't realize that Sadducees and Pharisees made it up. What's likely happening here is he realizes it's a pretty mixed group. So of the Sanhedrin that is present, it seems to be a pretty good mix between Sadducees and Pharisees. He could probably tell by based on what they're wearing, like what they are. And so he realizes, oh man, I've got like a pretty even split between those who have shown up. So he continues, verse 6. He says, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am being judged because of the hope of the resurrection of the dead. Again, Paul's problem here, the Jewish religious leaders, why they don't like Paul, why they don't like the Christians, is that the resurrection of Jesus is the central claim. It is the central claim of the Jesus movement. And so he's being arrested for claiming that this Jesus guy is the Messiah, and then he rose from the dead. So that's why he's being on trial, because of his hope in the resurrection of the dead. Verse 7, when he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say, there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit. But the Pharisees affirm them all. The shouting grew loud, and some of the scribes of the Pharisee party got up and argued vehemently, we find nothing evil in this man. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him? Now, again, it's just helpful to know, like, why does it seem like they're now defending Paul if they don't like Paul? Again, this is just, like, high level here. Helpful to know this. Generally speaking, the Sadducees prioritize the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. This is also known as the Pentateuch. So they prioritize the first five books of the Bible. The Pharisees, on the other hand, prioritized the entire Hebrew Bible, as they had at this point, as well as various oral traditions that were not in Scripture itself, but they were kind of created as a guardrail to make sure you don't break the commands of Scripture. So, as a side note, there are times in the Gospels when the Pharisees accuse Jesus of breaking the law, and when that happens, Jesus actually never breaks the laws in the Hebrew Scriptures, but what he does do sometimes is he does not follow the oral traditions that they have created on top of the law. So the Pharisees have oral traditions, extra writings, plus the Hebrew Bible. Now, the reason why there's a big difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and listen, we're going to like go Bible nerd here, so I don't know if you're excited about this, but I am. So here's the note. The reason there's a difference between them is because the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, that the Sadducees really value, there is not very much about angels, spirits, and eschatology, which is a fancy way of saying the end of the world, where the resurrection of the dead is going to happen and God is going to judge the living and the dead. There's not a lot there in the first five books of the Bible. And so for them, angels, spirits, the resurrection, the afterlife was very minimized for them. For them, it was like this. You're supposed to honor God with your life so that you will be blessed in this life. So it's not about going to heaven when you die or that sort of thing. It's about being a faithful Jew so that you will be blessed here, that you'll be given favor here. It's not quite apples to apples, but if you're like, what's the point? Like, why be a Sadducee if like this is all there is and you only have this life? It's kind of like, if you think of it a little bit this way, like the prosperity gospel that says, hey, if you follow Jesus and you're faithful, then you'll be healthy, wealthy, and wise and get everything you want. Again, there's a lot of differences between the Sadducees and the prosperity gospel, but it's that sort of thing. So it wasn't about resurrection or heaven. It's about, hey, follow the law. So in this life, you'll be blessed. You'll have children. You'll have a legacy, that sort of thing. Now, the Pharisees believe in a final resurrection at the end of time. Now, they would reject the fact that Jesus resurrected right now, because obviously that doesn't happen, but they do accept that there is going to be a final resurrection when Jesus judges the living and the dead at the end of time. And so their position, while they reject Jesus, is at least more open to Paul and the Christians, because they are open to spirits and angels and revelation. In fact, the Pharisee position is that God or an angel can speak to people. Again, if you read the Old Testament, especially the prophets, that's what happens, is that God or spirits or an angel reveals God's message to the prophets, and they tell Israel. So they're open to this sort of thing. And as far as a judicial proceeding is concerned here, Paul actually has not done anything wrong. So just by claiming that he has experienced Jesus or that God has spoken to him, according to the Pharisees, that's not out of bounds. And they might not agree with Paul, but according to their theology, that actually does happen. Now, on top of that, last thing I'll point out here, the Pharisees and the Sadducees were always fighting for power. They were always fighting for power. It's not, again, apples to apples, but you can think of maybe a modern American politics, like Democrats and Republicans. You're trying to fight for the White House or the House or the Senate. You're trying to fight to have your majority to pass your laws and your regulations. In fact, so what happens now in like modern American day politics is like really it just seems like each side, instead of like trying to do their own job, they're just trying to find out where the other side is wrong and like really exploit that. So like if their own, you know, colleagues did something wrong, it's like, hey, let's not talk about it. But if the other people do something wrong, they try to make it a big deal. It's kind of like this, you know, ever since the first Donald Trump presidency, which I kind of figured is probably here from here on out, like no matter who's president, they're always trying to impeach everybody, right? So Trump was impeached the first time. Biden was attempted to be impeached his presidency a couple of weeks ago. Letters of impeachment were brought against Trump again. It's really like nobody really cares in some ways what's right or wrong. They just want the other side to like be out of power. And so really that's what's happening here. It's not that the Pharisees support Paul, or they certainly don't support his belief in Jesus. But the Pharisees do support the resurrection, and they seize the chance to embarrass the Sadducees here. So really, it's like politics under the guise of religion. And so what's happening here is Paul's very shrewd. His intentions worked, that a big disagreement breaks out over theology, and therefore they can't find common ground to indict Paul of anything because they're arguing with each other. So if they can't indict Paul, then like Paul can't, you know, theoretically like stay in custody. They can't find common ground because they're like arguing with each other. So verse 10, it says this, when the dispute became violent, the commander feared that Paul would be torn apart by them and ordered the troops to go down, take him away from them, and bring him into the barracks. In other words, it was a modern day political meeting between two groups who really don't like each other. They don't actually get anything done. They just like don't like each other, and they don't want the other side to look good. And so the problem works out for Paul. The problem for the Romans is that the Roman authorities still don't have a verdict on what Paul did wrong or what to do with Paul. And according to Roman law, he hasn't done anything wrong. And so they allow the Jewish leaders to come to a conclusion, but they also can't give an answer to what Paul has done wrong. And so they're in a predicament with what to do with Paul. Again, for the Romans, you're like, well, why don't they just release him? He caused a massive riot, and that is not good in the ancient world. And so they can't like just act like nothing happened, but they can't charge him with anything. So they're in a problem. Verse 11, we'll keep reading. It says, the following night, the Lord stood by him, this is Paul, and said, have courage, for as you testified about me in Jerusalem, so it is necessary for you to testify in Rome. So in Rome, the capital city. Now, what's happening here is it's probably a vision. Paul is told that he is somehow, some way going to go to Rome and will be given the opportunity to testify about the gospel in the world's most powerful city. Which, by the way, is a fulfillment of what we read about in Acts chapter 9, where Paul has this radical conversion experience on the road to Damascus. Then you have Ananias, who was the Jewish Christian in Acts 9, not the high priest. He's told to go meet with Paul, but he's afraid because he knows that Paul has killed Christians. And then Acts 9, it says this, but the Lord said to him, so the Lord visits this guy Ananias, he says, go, "For this man, Paul, is my chosen instrument to take my name to the Gentiles, kings and Israelites. I will show him how much he must suffer for my name." And so what happens next in Acts 23 is that this scene reconfirms that Paul is in considerable danger. What happens next is his nephew, Paul's nephew, uncovers the fact that more than 40 Jews have taken a vow to murder Paul. So these 40 guys say, "We're not going to eat or drink until we kill Paul." The plan is to intercept Paul the next day when he's brought back for another hearing because they're trying to figure out what he's done wrong. So Paul's nephew visits Paul in prison. He tells Paul about the plan, and then Paul tells his nephew to tell the Roman commander what's going on, so the nephew reports the plot to the Roman commander, who tells the nephew not to let anyone know what's going on, but like he's glad that he lets him know. And so, again, for the commander, if something happens to Paul under his care, when Paul has not yet been found guilty, it would not go well. So he has, this is like a really high-profile case, so he's got to make sure everything's going to happen well. And so because of their plans, the Romans' plans for handling Paul is changing because they don't want Paul to be killed. So we'll pick up the story, verse 23. It says this. "He," the Roman commander, "summoned two of his centurions and said, 'Get 200 soldiers ready with 70 cavalry and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Also provide mounts to ride so that Paul may be brought safely to Felix the governor.'" In other words, Paul here gets a massive escort. I mean, this thing is huge. However, given the volatility of the situation and the political ramifications, if this does not go well, Paul has to be protected. So again, at this point, Paul is not a nobody, and such a strong temple reaction against him that this massive riot can come out of nowhere because of this man, it needs to be figured out because they have to keep the peace in the region, and they definitely have to keep peace in the temple in Jerusalem. So he has to be dealt with. But again, think of this as like a really high-profile case. Everything has to be done right, or like it's not going to go well. So he's going to get transferred to Felix, who is the governor of the region. He had the highest legal authority, and he's stationed in Caesarea Maritima, which is about 60 miles northwest of Jerusalem. So Paul has to take a 60-mile journey to go see the governor. Verse 25, it says this, "He wrote the following letter." So the Roman commander writes this letter of introduction to Felix the governor, so the governor knows what's going on. It says this, verse 26, "Claudius Lysias," who is the Roman commander, "to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man had been seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them, I arrived with my troops and rescued him because I learned that he was a Roman citizen." Now, again, if you were with us last week, that's not exactly how that kind of went down, but, you know, he's got to look good. Verse 28, "Wanting to know the charge that they were accusing him of, I brought him down before their Sanhedrin. I found out that the accusations were concerning questions of their law." In other words, this is Jewish religion and practice. That's what, like, the Jewish leaders are convicting Paul of. It continues, "and that there was no charge that merited death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there was a plot against the man, I had sent him to you right away. I also ordered his accusers to state their case against him in your presence." Now, I want to point this out. Luke, who is the author of Acts and the Gospel of Luke, continues here to show Paul following the steps of Jesus when Jesus was unjustly condemned. So just like Pilate, who was in charge at the time of Jesus, found nothing legally of which Jesus was found guilty of breaking according to Roman law, so the same is true for Paul. In fact, Luke uses the same words here when he says there is no charge against him. It's the same words that Pilate has is told. Like, according to Roman law, like I know, like there's like a religious dispute behind between you guys, but according to Roman law, you actually have not done anything wrong. And so, like Jesus, although Paul has also not been found guilty, he is still not going to be released. Verse 31, it says this, "So the soldiers took Paul during the night and brought him to Antipatris as they were ordered." This is about halfway to Caesarea. "The next day, they returned to the barracks, allowing the cavalry to go on with him to finish the journey." Verse 33, "When these men entered Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, he asked what province he was from." So where Paul's from. "He learned that he was from Cilicia, which is a Roman province. It's the city of Tarsus where Paul was born." This is where Paul's from. Verse 35, "He said, 'I will give you a hearing whenever your accusers also get here.' He ordered that he," that is Paul, "be kept under guard in Herod's palace." And so what starts with Paul's arrest in Acts 22 at the temple due to the Jews and the mob that was created around Paul now leads to Paul going to the governor of the area to figure out what to do with him. Now, this is Acts 23, and I want to point this out. Like, this passage may just look like a courtroom drama, and it's like, okay, this is interesting, but what do we do with it? Like, I guess the history is interesting, but if you're like following Jesus in 2025 and you read this story, it's like, this is great, but how does this apply to my life? Because it doesn't seem like there's any clear spiritual lessons here or wisdom for us. And yet, I would say this, Paul's situation is not what you would expect from someone faithfully following God. He's done the right things, he's spread the gospel, he's apologized for anything he's done wrong, and yet he is being unjustly imprisoned. So if your idea of like, if I do the right thing, God's got to bless me, like Paul, that is not happening to Paul. And so what I want to do with this text is I just want to give us a couple of things to take away from this text. Again, our question this morning is if we think faithfulness should feel like progress, but what if it doesn't? Because this is Paul's story, man. Like, I'm doing the right things, going to the right places, and now I'm like going the exact opposite. I'm being imprisoned, might be facing the death penalty, but he's been really faithful. So clearly his journey has not been the progress that you and I might expect. So a couple of things. First thing I would say this. What we see from this story, from this text, is that faithfulness may not look successful, but it's never wasted. Faithfulness may not look successful, but it is never wasted. Again, from the worldly perspective, man, Paul is going in the opposite direction. Can I just say that, man, sometimes, being faithful means standing in the tension and not escaping it. Sometimes being faithful means because I'm following Jesus, I'm experiencing this difficult time or I'm going to have to do this hard thing. And instead of escaping the tension, it might just mean I have to live in this because, not in spite of, but because of my faithfulness. Sometimes being, again, doing the right thing, following Jesus, doesn't lead you to where you want to go. Listen, those of you that call New City Church home, like, we're in the midst of a transition. We're in a new space. We've had staff transitions. We're trying to figure out new rhythms. And so it's like, oh, yeah, you know, I like to joke about this too. You know, New City's 8 years old. And for the first time, we're meeting portably in a school. So, like, that doesn't seem like, typically you start in a school and you get your own space. We're going a different direction, right? So faithfulness, it doesn't always look like, quote, unquote, success. But it could be where God is actually leading you. See, for us as followers of Jesus, we just do the best that we can. And then there is this call to trust God with what God wants to do. Now, we are going to see over these next couple of chapters as we conclude Acts, some really awesome and like neat, cool things happen. But it's going to happen because Paul's journey is not successful. We're going to see some really interesting and amazing things happen because, not in spite of, but because Paul's journey is not what you would think would be quote unquote successful. So faithfulness may not look successful, but it's never wasted. Another thing for us to point out as we read stories like this is that God does not give us the same path, but he does give us the same call. God does not give all of us the same journey, the same trajectory, but he does call us to the same thing. And so I just want to maybe encourage you this morning that you or I, we cannot compare our life or what God is doing in our life or where God is leading us or even our outcomes with other people, with other faithful followers of Jesus. I think what's hard sometimes is there is no, like, after following 5 years of following Jesus or 10 years of following Jesus, that this is exactly what my spirituality is going to look like and my sanctification is going to look like at year 5 and year 10 and year 15. Like, that is not a thing. And so we sometimes think, well, this person's been following Jesus like as long as I have, but they seem to be here and I seem to be here. Is there something wrong with me? Listen, following Jesus is not a linear progression. In fact, in the New Testament, we see, even in the book of Acts, we see that Paul's story is different than Peter's story. It's different than John's story. It's different than James's story, all faithfully following Jesus, but going in radically different directions. It's kind of like this. If you have kids, if you have multiple kids, you know that your kids have different interests. They have different personalities. They have different skills. They have different desires. They have different journeys. They have different friends. And you don't expect them to end up in the same place in their life. You don't expect all your kids to live in the same place and have the same job and have the same friends and the same interests. You don't expect that. And yet, you can still be happy and proud and excited for your kids going on their different paths. So they're still your children, but their lives are going to look different. You should be happy where they end up. And so listen, for those of us that are followers of Jesus, we are commanded to love God and love people. And sometimes what we can do as followers of Jesus, if we are not careful, is that we can put way more pressure on our life and our decisions and our future than Jesus does. again, the main question is, in this journey, in this relationship, in this job, in this moving situation, in this city, man, can I honor God? And can I love the people in that situation? If the answer is yes, then you actually can't make a wrong decision. You can't make a wrong decision. Now, it doesn't mean that one might not be better than the other, or one might not make you more money than the other. But in terms of faithfulness to God, if you can genuinely say, hey, I don't think this decision is dishonoring to God, and I can still love him and love the people he's put around me no matter what decision I make, then as a follower of Jesus, you have the freedom to make that decision, because God does not give us the same path, but he does give us the same call to respond to Jesus' grace and mercy in our life and to follow him. And so really, to sum it up, here's what I would say, especially from this text in the book of Acts, that in God's eyes, faithfulness is success. In God's eyes, faithfulness is success. In fact, if I could just point out to you, in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul writes this. Now again, if you call New City Church home, when we get to the green word, I just want you to say it out loud with me. He says this: a person should think of us in this way, those of us that are followers of Jesus, in this way, as servants of Christ and managers of the mysteries of God. In this regard, it is required that managers be found faithful. Now, this is a different space than our old one, and I couldn't hear you as well. So we're going to do this again. Verse 2, in this regard, it is required that managers be found faithful. Man, that's it. It is of little importance to me that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I don't even judge myself. What Paul is not saying here is only God can judge me, so I'm going to do what I want. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is whether or not you think I'm successful or have this big growing ministry or have tons of followers and you can judge like how good of a preacher I am. He's like, listen, I don't care. What matters to me is faithfulness to God, because in God's eyes, faithfulness is success. Again, what's happening here, at least in Corinthians, is that the Corinthians were probably judging Paul by outward results and appearances. Like, who's the more charismatic leader? Or between him and Apollos or Peter, like, who has the bigger following? Who's the best preacher? But Paul is pushing back hard here. He's saying, listen, faithfulness isn't measured by visible fruit or external success. It is measured by serving God with integrity. Now hear me, I'm not saying we shouldn't pray for fruit. I'm not saying we shouldn't like ask God to bless us and give us favor. I'm not saying these things are wrong. But that is not what faithfulness is measured by. It is about serving God where he has you with integrity. In fact, to point this out, I want to just read you one other verse. In Matthew 25, Jesus has the parable of the talents. And he basically gives three guys different amounts of resources. And he says, hey, be faithful what I've given you. And what happens in the story is two of the guys are faithful and they end up doubling what they are given. And so in this parable, the master gives these guys some talent, some resources. He travels. He comes back and he says this, verse 21 and 23, to both of the first two guys individually, he says this to them. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy. Now you may say, well, they were successful because they both like made more money than what they brought in. But here's what's interesting. The first guy, if you read Matthew 25, the first guy actually made double the amount of money as the second guy. The first guy made more money than the second guy, but they both get the same response. They get the same response. They were just faithful where they were, because in God's eyes, faithfulness is success. Their fruit was different, but they had the same faithfulness to God. And what happens too in the story too, the third guy buries it in a field and he does nothing with it. And so when the master returns, he is angry and he condemns the third servant. And he is condemned, listen, not for his lack of results. That's not why the servant is condemned. He is condemned for doing nothing. He is condemned for doing nothing at all. Because in God's eyes, faithfulness is success. It's success. That's what it is. And so I just want to encourage you as we end here to remain faithful where God has you. That how you live and what you do, it matters. And so just to give you some like real examples, like listen, if you're a mom and your season of life is different, you're like wrangling young kids, to love them well and to serve them well, like that matters. If you're a student, I mean, it's not necessarily getting straight A's, but it is like putting in an effort. Like it is trying. It's like, I'm going to study. I'm actually going to do my work. If you're a dad, if you're a father, it's like loving your kids, man, working hard at your job. If you're working, like wherever you find yourself, it's like doing it with integrity, like not gossiping about your coworkers or, going behind your boss's back because you don't like how they do things. Man, it's about being faithful where God has us. And listen, we do all of this. Paul does all of this in response to the gospel, that we are faithful to God because he was first faithful to us, that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Not because we were awesome or we promised to do better in the future or we started doing better right now, that in the midst of our sin and despair, Jesus stepped into dying, lived the perfect life you lived, could not live, I could not live, with joy takes the wrath of God against sin, evil, and wickedness so that you and I can experience the kingdom of God. And so as we remember this idea that in God's eyes, faithfulness is success, it's in response to the fact that, listen, in Jesus, you already have success because in Jesus, you have nothing to prove and no one to impress because Jesus has perfectly done everything for you.